woman any time. But there's some things that must be pointed out here. Now, one thing that impressed me, I didn't get it until this time around. Concerning our four societies, right here we're dealing with two mentalities and two societies. Whoopsie, whoopsie, I think this... No, it doesn't shake. Yeah, that's better. The two mentalities, the Babylonian, of course, and the brethren. They never achieve the brotherhoods completely, and they never go completely Babylonian. Nobody ever goes 100%, rarely, but societies do. They do get pretty bad. But in Moroni, you see, he describes his own people. You think, well, they're the nation, after all, as the poor and the outcast of Israel, and compares them with the Joseph sold into Egypt, the rent garment of Joseph, and so forth. Such are the traditions of the brotherhoods, and his opponent in this particular bout is Amalickiah, about whom we're told a good deal. The people here, right in this chapter here, the one we're dealing with right now, about the nature of these people, they would be the nobility at the end, the 45th verse, the last verse of the 45th chapter, rather, tells us that they were those who'd achieved great wealth and considered themselves nobility, and they are the would-be overlords, the powerful, the well-born. They call themselves the king men because they want a king, and their culture is Babylonian, so we have these two. Now, throughout the Book of Mormon, these two are in conflict. Not just these two, you notice that. The Book of Mormon scene is laying in America, north and south. A different story in each one, you notice. We have here the perennial Latin American history, which has been what? North or South, South and Central America. It has been the rich, the arrogant, the landlords, the estancieros, the hacienderos, tempting to take and hold by force what they think is their own. They're always staging coups, and they have to. But you have always this conflict, you notice, you see, in Latin American history. Are these people claiming superior birth and constantly attempting to hold their position by force and succeeding, usually, and staging coup after coup if necessary against the great majority who live as poor outcasts in the land most of the time, the campesinos, the paisanos, and so forth. Always between these two, it is still here. In North America, you don't have that, you notice. You have another contest. You have pioneers grabbing all they can take, everything up for grabs. Not all of them are idealists. Then you have a very truculent white father in Washington. Washington was the most benevolent of all toward the Indians. But since then, policy has been very, very truculent. And so we have the other two. We have the warlords against the primitives, or the... you needn't call them primitives. You can call them the... what are we calling them? The which? No, they're the nature people, we call them, of course. They live closest to nature. They depend on nature. They live on nature, see? But as a matter of fact, as you'll see in that great work that was got out by the Sismoni on this subject, almost 80% of the Indians of the time of Columbus were cultivators. They weren't hunters at all. They were farmers all up and down the Mississippi, all over the Southwest and so forth. All in New England, they raised the corn, the watermelons, the pumpkins, and the things like that. But against these two, the two lower cultures, see, on the same scale, the warlords and the primitives, see. So it's understandable why we have always taken, Washington has always taken in the Central America, when we've interfered in Central America, we've nearly always taken the sides of the warlords, you see. The two cultures on the lower scale, the warlords and the primitives, are engaged in the same contest as the two upper ones, Babylon versus the brethren. Now, the Book of Mormon scenario seems to support the final conclusion of the little heart that we mentioned the last time, namely that real driving force in the struggle lies with the abilities and ambitions of certain outstanding individuals. That's certainly the case here, what we have here. The two peoples here, we're told, the two armies, and we're told that again and again, they have no quarrel with each other any more than we did with the Germans and the Japs. Our quarrel was with Hitler, as far as that goes. A personal feud between, say, Hitler and Chamberlain, not Hitler and Chamberlain, but Hitler and... And Churchill, of course. And they they are the brethren, the quarrel between men and the men that lead them, yes, as far as that goes. In this case, Amalickiah has the well-known desire to be cosmocrator. He wants to rule. See, he wanted to be king of everything. He didn't make any difference whether it was Nephites, Lamanites, or anything else. He had his plans to take it all in, and he went step by step. He had it all planned out, and he worked it out very carefully, very skillfully, and now he's commanding a huge army. But he's no longer commanding the Nephites because of this abrupt setback they have at the point we reached, where they couldn't take one town. It made all the difference in the world. The Book of Mormon is telling it like it is, even to this day, then, and that's why it behooves us to pay attention here. Now, I think we'd best follow off here to save time. Never done this before, but I follow the handbook here. Might do that, see? But we've got down to where they couldn't take this one place. Notice well, here we are, 23rd. The chief captains were all slain, and more than 1,000 of the Lamanites were slain. There wasn't a single soul of the Nephites that was slain. Well, that was a great disappointment. Why should they give up there? They were way ahead, but the campaign completely collapsed. Campaigns do collapse as far as that goes. Churchill's great Italian campaign completely collapsed. After a tremendous expenditure and great superiority, it went to nothing. The same thing with this market gardening thing into the Netherlands. Monty's dagger thrust at the heart of Germany and so forth. After this tremendous expenditure of arms and everything else, went to nothing. We just had it fall back and nothing came. So these things can happen. One rebuff in one city, just Arnhem, just because they couldn't take Arnhem. Back they went. The whole thing collapsed. We had armies in there and divisions and paratroopers and everything else. Didn't work at all. So the same thing here. They couldn't take this one city, the city of Noah, and so the whole thing, it says, they collapsed. The Lamanites went all back home. The Lamanites, when they saw that their chief captains were all slain, see, they had no more leaders, they fled into the wilderness. They went back home again and went back to inform their king Amalickiah what had happened. Notice here, Amalickiah, who was a Nephite, his army is Lamanite now. He hasn't got a Nephite. He's got this big, huge Lamanite army behind him. You notice using Lamanites for career this is perfectly normal. Again, after all, the Swiss guards are the Pope. Who are they? No Catholics. No Catholic can be in the Pope's Swiss guard. They all have to be Protestant, because that means they can be trusted just for pay and pay alone. They're not interested in politics or anything else. And the same thing, we use the Contras to do fighting down there, you see. We're not getting in there at all. But been using them. Were the Varangian guards. They were the backbone, of course, of the defense of the Byzantine Empire. The Varangian guards were recruited from the Russians and the Rus and the Goths. They were a mixture of barbarians, and they were paid, but they ran the country, and they put emperors in and out, just like the Praetorians did in Rome. Or the Mamelukes for centuries, who ruled in Egypt they were nothing but slaves who had been liberated when they became Muslims and formed into soldiers. But they couldn't be Egyptians. They were the guard. They were the palace guard. But the Mamelukes, then they ruled the country until it was in 1811 that Muhammad Ali, in one night, had a massacre, and they were all slaughtered. That ended the rule of the Mamelukes. But they ruled until that happened. So it very often happens, see, that a person rules by an army that isn't his own people. That's the only kind he can trust, as a matter of fact. They'll accept pay, they'll accept reward, and nothing else. Nothing else holds them. But when Amalickiah found that the whole thing had flopped, he took that as a personal plan. He did get angry. He blew his top. He screamed and ranted and had a tantrum as only a general can. He was exceedingly wroth and did curse God, swearing that he would drink, with an oath, he would drink Moroni's blood. See, it's this personal rivalry between the two, of course, the same sort of thing. Then, this was in the board, but he fell back. They had to lick their wounds for a while because he fell back, and there was a period of peace and prosperity. It only lasted 5 years, this peace and prosperity. And then, in the 50th chapter here, things were too good to be true. Moroni knew that, and so he went right on. After all, this was not a real stop. The army was still intact, and Malachi was still determined to use it, his forces. So Moroni went on fortifying things and commenced the standard fortifications, the ditches and the palisades, the top of the timbers, the height of a man, and so forth, and the pickets and the towers, the lookout towers and the places of security, and all these things in the first part of the chapter 50. And then there's this salient. It's impossible to draw a map of this, except that you know that there was a there was a line running from east to west, the main line, and there was a salient out here in the east. There was the sea here and the sea here. That's as much as we'll dare to say. And he has to straighten this out. He does it very nicely. This is very, very nicely expressed in, you might say, in technical terms here, where he says in the seventh and eighth verses here. See what we have here. Yes. First of all, it's necessary to move a dangerous salient over on the east coast. The area was cleared of Lamanites. Notice they drove all the Lamanites who were in the east wilderness into their own lands. They were soldiers. That was Lamanite country. They just settled there. They drove them out because they weren't going to straighten the line here, which makes it, of course, easier to hold, much easier to defend. You can't have flanking or anything like that. And then what he did to them, he settled his own people there and colonists from Zarahemla, people who were already there. And so it says here, and in the ninth verse, you see, took their own, which went north, he caused that the inhabitants from the land of Zarahemla should move in, and the land round about should go forth into the east wilderness and possess the land. So they settled that. It was settled by Lamanites and people from Zarahemla. And the reason was, as he says in the eighth verse, the land of Nephi did thus run in a straight course from east to west, a much easier line to defend. But he was no fool. He wasn't going to have a Maginot line there. Not him. So we straightened it out. I see, you can see that would be a very dangerous salient otherwise. So then he went on with his fortifications, fortifying them in depths. You notice fortifying the land between the Nephites and Lamanites. The land of Nephi running from the west sea by the head of the river Sidon. That's the head of the river. I suppose that's the source of the river. Well, it's the head of the river where it empties. I don't know. Sidon goes the other way, I think. Well, the Nephites possessed all the land northward, northward of the land Bountiful, and so this is Bountiful here, and they have all this land north. South is the Lamanite land at this time, the country at this time. Bountiful is the one strong place that the Lamanites never can take, almost never. They hold on to that to the bitter end. Well, what's going to happen here? Amroni, with confidence building up, his armies increased daily, and he began the foundations of a city. And this is his building in depth, you notice. Found cities everywhere. Now, can you found cities so quickly and easily? The 14th verse here, the 15th chapter. They began found of days for a city of Moroni and a city of Aaron, joining Aaron and Moroni. They called the name, notice they joined the borders together, the name of the city Nephiha. A very interesting ending there. And they also began in the same year to build many cities in the north. Well, if you know the Hopi record and Tizuni, that's exactly what they do. They settle. It's hard to believe to go to an ancient city, you go from Moenkopi, and it looks just exactly like Walpi. But Walpi's been there for 1,000 years, and Moenkopi was only founded in 1906. They move them all around. They shift them, the Shiponkvi, Shimalpi, Awatobi was destroyed, according to the 16th century, and then they rebuild them, they move all over, they're constantly moving, they move up to Pima. So at one time, you see, the claim, you see, the Navajos is they claimed all the Anasazi territory. They're the inheritance of the Anasazi. They're all over the southwest and so forth. They kept moving their settlements. And you know, you do find the great mystery. They talk about the mystery of why you can find something like Checo Canyon or something. Why did they leave it? Why? Well, they would just get up and leave and go from one place to another when things are, well, it could be weather or something like that. But the point is, they're very ready to move and very ready to resettle. You would think they're very stable because they build towns, they're the Pueblo, the city people, but they do move and they do resettle and they do like to spread out and form different settlements, sometimes large, sometimes small. That's what he's doing when he calls it a city, anything with walls around it in this case, and anything defensive. And they began the same year to build many cities on the north, and so it went, you see. The Lord prospered them extremely. They blessed with a post-war boom here in the 18th verse. Prospered them exceedingly, and they became exceeding rich. Again, isn't that too sudden? No. After every war, people become very rich all of a sudden. You can see why, because there's an increase in supply and increased demand after everything's been destroyed. There's a lower population, less population pressure. Everybody can profit a lot. There are lots of deals around after a war. And so, but we never learned this, the 13th, 17th, and 19th, and 20th verse. Back to the old lesson. How often is this repeated in the Book of Mormon? How just and merciful they should have celebrated the Lord in fulfilling all his words unto the children of men. Blessed art thou, and thy children, they shall be blessed inasmuch as they remember this, he says. But remember, inasmuch as they will not keep my commandments, they shall be cut off. And of course, there had to be now a land squabble. This always happens. You're going to have this. The people, you can't hold them to that. But And then here's a comment, the enemy, don't blame the enemy, don't blame Hitler, see? In 1927, when I, 77, I was on mission in Ludwigshafen, Germany was rearmed, that was a great ammunition center, it was all very secret, but they were working like crazy there, and the arrogance of the French was unspeakable, and the French soldiers would insult people and do things they didn't need, it was very silly. President Taddy used to tell us all the time, the missionaries, I'm expecting to see you all in uniform before long. Hitler wasn't even heard of then, you see? He wasn't the one that pushed us into it. It was all building up to that, you can see, by the injustice of the Versailles settlement and so forth. So this is what happens always, and here the quarrel has to be naturally on a boundary. We're always quarreling about boundaries. And here's a very interesting racial thing. Talk about you either find a Nephite or a Lamanite, the 22nd verse here. All those who are faithful in keeping commandments were delivered at all times. That's a wonderful thing to know. The others were fated to go into bondage or perish by the sword or dwindle in unbelief and mingle with the Lamanites. Large numbers dwindle in unbelief and become Lamanites. So when you see a Lamanite, he's as much Nephite blood as anything there. It's all over the place. They're all descendants of Lehi. So then, and this is a surprising thing. This is just after, you see, they've just had the big war, 1 year after. There never was a happier time among the people of Nephi in these great days of insecurity. But when were the greatest days of Athens? When the city was all locked up, when they were having the plague, when they had to have the long walls between the Piraeus, the harbor, and the city because nothing was safe outside, when all of Greece was united against them under the leadership of Sparta, when they were losing their shirt, they'd lost their empire because of their overweening ambition and wickedness towards cities like Miletus and so forth. And there they were, and this was their greatest and happiest period. There's something crazy about this. They're living high, so to speak. And this was to last for only 4 years. Back in the, yes, it tells us the, they were living in dangerous times. They're 51 and 9 here, yes. Malachi had been stirred up. Malachi is working hard all this time to build up his forces back there. Just as Hitler took lots of time, but worked fast just the same. And here's an episode. In the 24th year, I say, comes a land dispute about boundary disputes. These have come. The big one has been going on, of course, ever since. Ever since the boundaries were made, they've been changing all the time between the Hopis and the Navajos. They're always fighting about their boundaries, as the Indians are, and the Zunis and the tribal territories are very touchy matters. Of course, if you're on the wrong territory, you can be killed on sight and so forth. So in the fourth year, there was this contention concerning the land of Nephi and the land of Moriant. And here's the standard scenario. The people who possessed the land of Moriant and claimed part of the land of Lehi, and there was a warm contention between them. The main cause of tribal and lawsuits and so forth. That wonderful, my friend Paul Springer was a... He's a commissioner. He was my best friend. Well, I was a city commissioner in San Francisco, and a lawyer. And a big oil company was going to build a building in San Francisco, and they found that the building next to their lot, the people by mistake had extended the building out an inch beyond the property line. They say, "Well, you must sell us that inch, then. You must pay for that inch, and we'll charge $1 million." Well, that was a lot of money at that time. They said, "No, we won't. We'll shave the inch off. We'll just shave it off." But they didn't shave it off. They shaved 2 inches off. So Richfield couldn't go on and make a building without going all the way, and they had to buy that other inch, you see. See, they didn't shave 1 inch off, so they wouldn't have to pay for the land they trespassed on. But they shaved 2 inches on, so the others, if they wanted to build at all, would have to trespass and move over here. The buildings had to be together. And they charged them $2 million for that. They collected without any trouble, though it was a dirty trick. Well, this is the sort of thing, arguing about lands. And so much dirty work goes on about lands, of course. We all know that. We've all seen westerns. And the people in the land of Lehi fled to the camp of Moroni and asked for his assistance, and he cut them off. The thing, again, is back to the personality of the person. That's this Moriantin. We're told here that he had, notice in the 31st verse, he spoke to them with flattering words. Always they're skillful speakers, good salesmen, these men. And that was Moriantin. And they should flee to the land which was northward, and he cut him off. Moriantin couldn't get away with it. Who found that the people of Lehi had fled to the camp of Moroni. He was exceedingly fearful that Moroni should chase him, so they decided, we'll move up north to the land of waters, maybe the Central Valley of Mexico, which was full of water at that time, as you know. And Nephi was Moroni was able to find out about that because a maidservant of Morian, whom he'd beaten, a nice character reflection on his hot temper and so forth, he fell upon his maid and beat her much. And he was probably, he has one of his maids, you see, and a horrible man, this Morian, but a very capable man. She fled to the camp of Moroni and told everything. Moroni said it was time to cut him off, so he headed him off at the borders of the land desolation. And this was an army. It was, he didn't do it. He sent Tiancum. Tiancum is a very terrible general. Tiancum is really gung-ho. He's a great one. He's terrific for small operations like this. He was led, but he's too hot-headed and ferocious for most. Was led by a man whose name was Tiancum. And they had been led by flattering words, and Tiancum slew Morianton and defeated his army, and that was that. They all went back. Thus were the people of Morianton brought back, the 36th verse, a happy ending. They made a covenant. Remember, that means they have a ceremony by which they receive them back again. Restored to the land of Morianton, and a union took place between the people of Lehi, and they were restored to their lands. Notice the leader makes the difference. Morianton, once he's removed, things are taken care of. Well, then the case of the judgment. Now, here's a puzzling thing. Notice in 38. Here, a very righteous judge. And he's been perfect in perfect righteousness, this Nephiha, and you know, the Nephiha, yes, and perfectly upright. But he refused to let Alma take possession of the records. Well, why would he do that? Well, because Alma had given the records to Helaman, his son, 6 years before. His son was the head of the church. Alma had a different business. Remember, Alma had laid down his commission to become a missionary anyway. But it was this time. But the point is, why would he refuse to let Alma the Great take possession of the records? Well, Alma was an important government official and so forth, but the point is that if you will go back to the 37th chapter and the second verse, it tells us how Alma had conferred the whole thing upon his son Helaman 6 years before. So there's no mystery there, you see, as far as that goes. Thing is that you might think you find catches in the Book of Mormon. Joseph Smith must have slipped up here. Why would he refuse, a great judge, refuse the records to a great man like Alma, who was responsible for them, because Alma had passed them on. That was legal now, you see. And the son of Nephiha filled the judgment seat with an oath and ordinance. His name was Pahoran, and he's a famous man here. So we get to the 51st chapter. We waltz along here. Soon Moroni had to face the most dangerous coalition of all, for the king men had united again with those of high birth and all the others who sought power and authority over the people. The 5th and 8th chapters, notice, verses here of the 51st chapter here. Notice it tells us in the 5th verse, all those who were desirous that it was about the Pahoran, they wanted to make some changes of the laws. See, and Pahoran wouldn't change them, and they wanted to change them in their favor, so they decided to make a coup. And they were desirous that Pahoran should be dethroned from the judgment seat, were called the king men, were desirous to establish a king. But they staged an election instead, and the king men lost. There was nothing wrong with their having an election with their challenging the government at all. They could do that. Thing is, when they lost the election, they took to arms. They wouldn't accept the verdict, you see. They wouldn't accept the majority. You notice if you look back at the last verse of that 45th chapter, we mentioned it before. These are the same people, and Amalickiah is the same old character. Because of their exceeding great riches, therefore they grew rich in their own eyes, would not give heed to their words to walk in uprightness with God. But they just didn't form another party as far as that goes. They wanted to run the government, which is exactly what Amalickiah wanted to be. He wanted to be everything, insomuch that they noticed they were gathered together against their brother. They were threatened, and now behold, they were exceeding wroth, insomuch they were determined to slay them. See, it was going to be a pooch, going to be all out. It wasn't just going to be an election. And here an election is forced on them, but it goes against them, and the voice of the people came in favor of the freemen. Now, those who were in favor of kings were those of high birth, here we are again, who sought to be kings. Everybody thought that he was in royal line because they were all related to the king. And they were supported by those who sought power and authority over the people as a coup thereafter. Amalickiah had again stirred up the Lamanites. Malachi isn't here. These people are among the Nephites. See, Amalickiah is on the other side, but he's got his Lamanite army, and he's stirring them up again. And he gathered together a wonderfully great army. And of course, the best interest for these people, once they'd lost the election, would be to join with Amalickiah. And so they plan with him, they plot with him, and from this time on, see, they're plotting against the country here. And Amalickiah did himself come down at the head of the Lamanites. This time he did. Notice, Amalickiah is now no longer, it said, Amalickiah the Nephite, who is leading the Lamanites. Now Amalickiah is the leader of the Lamanite army. He's identified himself complete with the Lamanites, and he's leading them. It's his personal army, again, like the Mamluks or the Varangians or the Praetorians. And the kingmen were glad. See, they were aware of what Amalickiah was doing, and they wanted to give him support. So they refused when Moroni, now it's time to arm against, he'd been getting ready for them all the time, they refused to cooperate. They wouldn't have anything to do with it as far as that goes. And Moroni, seeing everything going to pot here, was exceedingly wroth. He had a hot temper too, you know. His soul was filled with anger against them. These people, what are they doing here? About this, what we got here, was wroth then. When Moroni saw all his work threatened by the same elements with whom he had been forced to deal before, it's almost more than he could stand. Yea, he was exceeding wroth, his soul was filled with anger. He knew that the people were solidly behind him, and by popular vote received a special power to go against those king men and pull down their pride and nobility. Meantime, they had armed and were arming to support the Lamanites and went on to the attack, as we find here. But notice, and it came to pass, because this passage has been misunderstood here, the 17th verse here, came to pass that his army should go against those, his army marches against those of the king men and pull down their pride and nobility. He marches against them with their army. It's going to be a pitched battle. Notice here. Their armies did march forth against them and did pull down their pride. Inasmuch as they did lift their weapons of war to fight against the men of Moroni, they were hewn down only when they were fighting in the field. That's all. They're not executing them because they're the wrong party or something. As they did lift their weapons of war to fight against the men of Moroni, they were hewn down. But those that didn't were taken prisoner and held in the prisoners. They weren't shot. They were held in prison because there was no time to try them. The emergency was too great to have trials at that time, it says. There were 4,000 of those who were hewn down, but the leaders, you'd expect them to be eliminated, they weren't. They were cast into prison, and there was no time for their trials at that time. They were not killed. So there's a military, not a political contrast. The prisoners of war were not killed. And again, you see, the remainder of those, they yielded to the standard of liberty, and they were compelled to hoist the Tower of Liberty upon their title of liberty on their tower. Now that sounds like an oxymoron, an Irish bull, doesn't it? They were compelled to be free. They were compelled to have liberty. No, the point is here, it must be one flag or another. They had chosen decision by arms and they had lost. Well, the winning side hoists its flag. That's all there is. And they were good Nephites. They're supposed to have been Nephites. These are ones that had agreed and given up. This is the policy Moroni always follows, and had gone back to being supposedly good Nephites. How reliable, I don't know. Their officers are kept under guard, and those that were slain were all slain in battle, as they raised their arms to fight. So the victor's flag goes up, of course, and thus Moroni put an end to the kingmen. And their stubbornness and pride of those who possessed the blood of nobility, for they were brought down to humble themselves like unto the brethren, and to fight valiantly for the freedom and bondage. And they joined in after that. This happens before too. Behold, it came to pass that while Moroni, because while this was going down, having all this trouble just among themselves, Moroni, Malachi was building up a tremendous army, and now the Lamanites came into the land and caught them completely by surprise and overran everything. Well, where is Moroni's skill? Where are his preparations? They overrun city by city here, showing they were small. They hadn't even been built yet completely. Notice this is what happened. They came to Malachi, took possession of the city, the first of all, the city of Moroni, and drive them, slaying many, and they would flee from one city to the next and throw everything into confusion. The army would come along. It's a real blitzkrieg, you know, possession. And those who fled out of the city of Moroni came to the city of Nephihah. It's like check dams, you know, up the canyon. They think they'll hold back the flood, but they're a bad thing because they're weak dams, and the one that breaks first, that doubles the force of water. It comes down and easily breaks the second and then breaks the third. So they've stopped check dams in California, which used to be a policy, because they just made flooding worse. Because one of the little dams is bound to break, and that just doubles the mass of water behind, and then it goes down. So this is, and they came, notice, city of Nephihah and also the people of Lehi gathered themselves together and made preparations to receive the Lamanites. And they went to battle, but they kept them down by the seashore. Well, and he went on, he had to hold back, notice. He wouldn't suffer his forces to go to back. He had to hold back some in reserve. You have to have reserve. This reminds me so much of the night of the 16th of December in 1944. I was in charge of the intelligence. See, the 101st, we had gone into rest area at a place called Mourmelon, just behind the lines there, behind the Belgian line, and I had to keep up the situation. Everybody was resting. It was all over. Nobody thought it was serious, but it was very serious, and I could see it coming for several weeks. And that night, all of a sudden here, Malbody, Vissé, all these places, suddenly the Germans are here, they're here. Well, how did they get there? The general was absolutely amazed, everybody. Well, I wasn't amazed. I've been telling them that for weeks. I knew how it had built up. But they'd achieved in the Battle of the Bulge complete surprise, you see. There were the 6th Panzer Army. They had 12 panzer divisions, 12 armored divisions. They had 29 normal divisions, all breakthrough at once. And we didn't even know they were there, didn't even pretend. They kept such secrecy and so forth. But the signals were there all the time, and we wouldn't take them. This is the way it happened. They had Manteuffel's 5th Army, and he was something. And they had Sepp Dietrich's 6th Army. And these were tremendous. The last fighting force that Hitler had, and he was going to throw them into one place on the line where we had, we had 4 divisions spread out. We had them spread out at an average of 28 miles to the division front. Well, the normal division front should be 4 miles to hold, 5 miles at most. 4 to 5 miles a division should hold. But we had each division holding 28 miles because we said, well, nothing's going to happen there. This is the Ardennes. They can't come through the Ardennes, these woods and so forth. And it was, everybody felt perfectly secure. I say I didn't. I felt very nervous. And I told the general, and he always complimented me about that. I said, well, you certainly called your shots that time. But it didn't do any good then. But then about 2 o'clock in the morning, a captain staggers in, his face all muddy, all black, torn uniform and so forth. His whole company had broken and just scattered. There was nothing left of them at all. And this is the first we heard of them. So the next morning, they had to go out and jump into these big gondola trucks, get all the men into them, and haul them out to Bastogne, to hold Bastogne. And that was one of the great epics of the war, the holding of Bastogne against all these German divisions. But throw them all in, but it caught them by complete surprise. No reason at all. Of course, they were very beautiful security. They had everything. They moved by night, but they moved with bicycles. The line was like this. Well, the day before we sent down, we got nervous. They're not sending us any reports. There hasn't been any reconnaissance here. There haven't been sent any scouts or anything else. So we went down to Corps, and it was the 7th Corps that said, well, don't bother us. We're going to move tomorrow. We're packing our maps and things. Well, what about the 109th Division, the Lionhead? They just moved in. They were holding the main line where Rundstedt was going to break through. Well, it wasn't Rundstedt. It was really Model was going to break through. And they had only been in Europe for 2 weeks. They'd never seen any action at all. They were a brand new division, just been formed. The general, the fat little red-headed, right, arrogance, you know, the great general. But they were there because it was a rest area. They put them there and said, this is the quietest area on the front. We won't have to do anything. We're going to fall back in a week, and we're just here to rest because this is no place where they won't have any. They have no experience, therefore, this is the best place for them. Of course, this is the place to which the Germans were going to direct. The whole attack was going to come right through there. It was wild. But I say, here, the lines were this place, but they were not building their fortifications this way at a certain place. They were building them this way. Well, what's going on here, you see? And all night long, they move just by night. They move in wagons and bicycles and push baby buggies, everything that wouldn't make a noise, you know. And they move down, and they move this way. We knew everything from here. Of course, we had the people would come over and tell us. We had scouts and so forth. They'd tell us they're moving this way by night, and they're moving this way by night, and where are they moving to? And here, they put up fortifications. Well, obviously, they're going to come through here, and they're going to protect their flanks. And this is where they're ganging up all their force. I mean, it was very obvious. And Hitler was hip on astronomy, and a favorite date of his was 17th of December, when other things had happened in his life. So I predict on the 17th of December there would be the big breakthrough there. There would be the 6th Fallschirmjäger. Because of reports, we had a pretty good roster of the units that had got together there. Well, what they were going to do, see, they were going to march, drive through with all this arm and so forth to Antwerp and cut off 20 to 30 American divisions there because they'd run out, completely run out of gas there. And they were throwing in 20 divisions plus 12 Panzer divisions. So it should have worked, but it didn't work because everybody blundered, of course, on both sides. This always happens. But after all, our generals did show great skill after the fighting began. They were no fools. I think they outwitted the Germans, actually. They should have known better than to try to go with tanks through those muddy paths through the Ardennes. There were narrow roads, hilly country, woods, and so forth. And even with all this, they stalled. They were bound to stall down, stall anyway. But the way they were cut off, the way we were met, was rather skillfully done. Well, anyway, this is what happens here. Why would he catch the great Moroni by surprise? Well, he didn't. He came in with his force, and he just bowled over one city after another. He says, taking one, he went on taking possession of many cities, it says in the 26th verse. The city of Lehi, and then the city of Morianton, then the city of Omner, and then the city of Gid. Well, you can imagine how the panic would spread among the Nephites. And the city of Muloch, all of which were on the eastward by the seashore. That's the place where they tried to strengthen it, you know. And thus had the Lamanites obtained by the cunning of Amalickiah, who was a darn good general, so many cities by their numberless host, and all of them were strongly fortified after the manner of the fortification, all of which afforded strongholds for the Lamanites. They were their forts now. All that work had been done just for the benefit of Amalickiah. He had all these strong places which would serve him very well, and which they did. The Nephites are going to have an awful time trying to take them back now. That's one of their main things, because after all, how are they equipped for siege operations? Moroni had fixed it perfectly so the cities couldn't be taken. Well, they were taken, now he had to take them again. And they went to the land bountiful, driving the Nephites before them. See, it's quite a scene, the people fleeing from one to another and coming in droves. You see this all the time, and everybody hiding the same place. And it came to pass, but this Teoncumus, he was great, who had slain Morianton, and he was awfully good, being repulsed by Teoncumus. And his men were great warriors. See, this 31st verse, Teoncumus has a very crack force here. Teoncumus did exceed the Lamanites in their strength and in their skill, man for man, you see. Insomuch they're very experienced that they did gain advantage over the Lamanites, but of course they couldn't fight a pitched battle, so very cleverly he starts Indian warfare, avoiding pitched battles. Of course, that's one advantage, you see, of an airborne. You can't form here, you scatter all over the place, and that gives you a great advantage, and the Germans resented it very much. They say you don't fight fair, you fight from behind trees and so forth. And they were very bitter against the 101st. It wasn't healthy to be picked up. They harassed them in so much as when it was dark, they worked in the night, or they fought Indian fashion. They avoided a pitched battle, and they engaged in, well, it wasn't terrorism. What do we call that war? My gosh, I can't remember my name these days. And they pitched their tents in the border by Bountiful, and Amalickiah pitched his tents on the borders by the land Bountiful. That's the strong Nephite strong point on the east coast there, and that's, if they can take that, everything is theirs. When the night came, Teoncumus and his servant, now this happens too, reconnaissance, scouting, patrolling, this has happened. Sometimes a high officer wants to go out himself and look things over, and then something happens. Teoncumus and his servant stole forth, went out by night to the camp of Amalickiah, and they were sleeping, overcome by the heat of the day. In the beginning of the next chapter, we remember that it was the New Year, which means they were in the tropics. The New Year's Day, they were overwhelmed by the heat. We've seen several references to that already. Put a javelin into heart and then returned again. Stories like this, you get a lot of them too. Mark Clark, without changing his uniform, in broad daylight, several weeks before they entered Rome, he drove all over downtown Rome as an officer, I say in his uniform, in broad daylight. Nobody recognized him. He drove out of the city again and inspected it. The same way, the New York Times, to put a test to our security, had three or four fellows dress up as German submarine officers in their uniforms, and talk nothing but German, ride the subways all day, walk around New York loudly talking German, in Nazi uniforms with swastikas and everything. And New York being what it is, nobody paid any attention to them. They thought, well, some gag or something. Nothing to it. Security is really a joke when you come right down to it, you know. It can be so easily broken. Well, these bombs in radios and things like that. Tape recordings. Well, anyway, then, 26th day of the year, see, they've lost their commander now. When the Lamanites woke up, of course, they're completely shaken up. They have to readjust. They have to because their commander's been killed. The first month, it was the first morning of the first month, so it was in the wintertime at any rate, and yet it was hot. They found Malachi was dead. It was in subtropical, at least. Tiancum was ready to give them battle, so they not only found their commander gone, but they found Tiancum all ready to attack. What would they do? Well, they were scared, and they didn't surrender because there were too many of them, you see. They could put up quite a fight. Tiancum didn't intend to attack them, but what you're going to do, they were affrighted, and no time to readjust, so they fell back on the city of Mulek. I suppose that was a sensible thing to do. City of Mulek was one of the most strongly defended cities, we learned. And the brother of Amalickiah took over, and he was just as ferocious as Amalickiah, and he was filled with desire for revenge, too. But this is the reason why Tiancum didn't do more in the fifth verse. Tiancum, because of the enormity of their numbers, Tiancum thought it was not expedient that he should attempt to attack them in their forts now. That's 52 years. Then, these dangerous circumstances. You notice this is very bad here. They fell back without a fight here in the second verse. Tiancum had strengthened his own positions. He dug in and awaited reinforcements from Moroni. That's the best thing for him to do, see, because he had a small force, a very good force, but a small. 6 and 7, verses 6 and 7 here. But he's pinned down on the west coast and could offer no assistance. Moroni was. The Nephites, with their inferior numbers, were being forced to fight the war that all commanders dread, a war on two fronts. Moroni was on the west coast, and Tiancum was on the east coast, so he couldn't help him because both of them had their hands full. That's the thing the German Wars College always said, you must always avoid no matter what happens. And he made the most of his advantage by sending a strong diversionary force to occupy Moroni, and if possible split the Nephite forces even more. He's going to pin Moroni down, while harassing them everywhere and keeping them off balance. Sallies, infiltrations from numerous Nephite strong places held by the Lamanites. So they have advantage all over the place there. And it says in the 13th verse, things were looking very serious for Moroni. Those were dangerous circumstances. It was thus the Nephites in those dangerous circumstances, the ending of the 26th year of the reign of the judges, just after they had celebrated a victory 5 years before. So what are we going to do here? Well, now, this was a real challenge for Moroni, and he was equal to it. He was very shrewd how he operates here. First, he ordered Tiancum to sit tight. Remember, he's on the east coast, and he has a good position anyway. On his sector, while harassing the Lamanites as much as possible. That's what he's good at. You see, you just bother, and you keep harassing them all the time. Keeping a sharp lookout for any chance opportunity opening to do them real damage. Well, that's the order he gives them in the 10th verse here. Seeking every opportunity to damage them as much as you can. You see. This is one of those undergrounds, like the Maquis, like the underground, like the Resistance, you see, in France and in other occupied countries. That's exactly what we're doing. We're acting like that he should be faithful in maintaining that what he had, but at the same time, not miss any opportunity to damage, and we've already seen that Tiancum would like to operate at night, where he could be more effective with his small but highly trained force. So, where are we now? Oh yes, here's a neatly authentic touch here. At the same time, he's instructed to take and keep as many prisoners of war as possible, with a view to future exchange with prisoners for the Lamanites. For the addition of one man to the Nephite forces meant a lot more than it did to one man for the Lamanites, would change them on a man-to-man basis, and it tells us in the 8th verse here. And he followed up these instructions with orders to make an attack on the city of Mulek and take it if it were possible. 16th verse. And this is a very authentic touch. But Tiancum decided it wasn't possible, so he didn't obey the order. I mean, he was allowed some discretion. He said, if it were possible. So Tiancum said, it isn't possible. And in the 16th and 17th verses, made preparations. Tiancum made all the preparations to make an attack on the city of Mulek. But what did he find out on scouting and patrolling? He saw that it was impossible, and he abandoned, and he gave up the enterprise, and that was that. And then Moroni came with an army to land Bountiful in the latter end of the 27th, and they had a council of war. The chiefs come together now. Bountiful's far enough away from the Lamanite forces to be safe, so they go there and held a top-level council of war and to study the situation. And it was agreed that the first thing on the agenda was for the united forces of Tiancum and Moroni to take Mulek, which was the eastern anchor of the main defense line, 18 and 19th verses there. But how could you take this major city? It was the most strongly fortified. It was the object they all wanted. Well, the first step was a logical one. They used the ancient custom of warfare, which is allowed. You challenge them to come out and meet you on a fair field. That was what you do. I treated that at some length in an article in the Western Political Quarterly, this coming out to challenge and so forth. And the Nephite commanders issued such an invitation to the comfortably ensconced Lamanites, who refused to come. Of course, they'd have been silly to do it, so they naturally refused. It was in Morocco, and all the forces, the city of Morocco, his forces, knights in armor, faced the city, all dressed up in full armor, all ready to go, and they formally challenged the Muslims to come out and fight. And they looked down from the walls. And the Muslims, of course, were the originators of chivalry, so to speak, because they always used those methods. That was part of their tradition, too. Very chivalrous people, and bloodthirsty, but chivalrous. And naturally, they refused because the hot sun was beating down, the hot African sun in the desert there. And here the army of St. Louis was all lined up. And then first one knight would, in heavy armor in the hot sun, you can imagine that. First one person would fall from a horse, then another, then another, then another, and the whole army was wiped out by the sun. They didn't have to lift a finger. Of course, they wouldn't come out and fight under those circumstances. Very sensible. What did I do with the water? I'm working on another project these days. I can't remember my own name. The other project's going very well. That's something else. That's no comfort. But here he goes on, you see. So they wouldn't come out. So what are you going to do now? Well, he tries something else. It's to try to decoy them out, and that's what he does. Tiancum, our very mobile and able Tiancum, he allowed the Lamanites to discover a task force of his moving along the coast. Like that. They're moving along right in full view of the city. And they gave it chase, of course. And when they were out chasing them, Moroni slipped in behind them into the city and overpowered the defenders. And since it was Moroni, he characteristically spared them all. He didn't put any to death, who yielded up the 27th to 25th verses. Then, having settled the city and people on his side, he then immediately, of course, started out chasing the Lamanites along the beach there. And they took the coast route on the heels of the Lamanites, and the Lamanites were chasing Tiancum and his small force. So we have Tiancum being chased by the Lamanites, Tiancum being chased by the Lamanites, and the Lamanites being chased by Moroni, you see. And so you see what's going to happen now. As a secondary division, this is what made the difference now, a small Nephite force under the terrible Lehi had issued out of the main base in Bountiful and met them. This isn't Bountiful, see, this is Mulek. And Bountiful's over here, and he came out and met them head on, and so here we have Lehi, another L, coming out and meeting them head on. Well, what they do, they're confused by the new development, and they decided to go back to Mulek, where they'd be safe. So, naturally, they turn around, and they come back, and they find Lehi coming up behind them. And it occurred to them with shock that by dashing forth of that city, they'd left it lightly defended. They better get back to Mulek before it was too late. Another reason it says that. 27th, 28th verses. So bent only on reaching home base in safety, the exhausted Lamanites with Lehi hot behind them ran smack into Moroni's army, you see. Lehi was hot behind them there. And into Moroni's army, and that was enough. They all surrendered. I think that was. It was the last straw, 28 to 32, and they fled in much confusion. They could not obtain the city of Mulek, and therefore Lehi could overtake them before they were wearied, because of the men of Lehi were fresh. And Lehi was not desirous to overtake them until they should meet Moroni and his army. Moroni commanded them they should fall upon the men until they had given up their weapons of war. That's usually came to pass that Jacob, being their leader, being a Zoramite, he was not to be conquered. An unconquerable spirit, he led the Lamanites forth to battle with exceeding fury against Moroni. He cut his way through to the city of Mulech, but behold, of course, it was already occupied by Moroni's men, so he couldn't give in there. And so a furious melee followed. With exceeding fury, Moroni was wounded and Jacob was killed. And then Lehi pressed upon the rear, that the Lamanites of the rear was delivered up, and they delivered up their weapons of war. And there, here's Lehi, Moroni, with his usual magnanimity here. He tells them, he says, Moroni, seeing their confusion, said to them, if you will bring forth your weapons of war and deliver you up, we will forbear shedding your blood. So they threw down their weapons, but there were many who would not. They were taken and bound and compelled to march to the land Bountiful, where they're building up a huge stalag. They're getting a lot of prisoners of war, and they need them, see, so they can exchange them for their own people and get the Nephites back. Oh, my land, I didn't realize we're not getting very far with these laborious campaigns, are we? We'll get to another subject still.